Welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So I'd like, please help me to welcome Jason K., a compulsive overeater from Pennsylvania.
I'm imagining a wellspring of applause and cheering as I see this clapping happening here. I'm a people person. I'm an extrovert. I'll want to connect with you. So if you're feeling me, you know, give me a thumbs up, give me a fake high five in the air, give me the head nod. It's going to really help me feel connected to you individually. I'll appreciate that feedback. I am Jason Kay. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and bulimic from just outside of Philadelphia here in Pennsylvania. And we're going to talk about something today that I'm very passionate about, recovery, but recovery as based on the directions out of the Big Book. So I'm just going to basically tell my story. It's going to be strong on step one because that's what took me a long, long time. I have, as of now, roughly 5.5 years of recovered abstinence, which means, you know, no cookies, cakes, candies, ice cream, like nothing. Total abstinence, no lapses, relapses, you know, nothing wonky. And that's a miracle. And I think you'll see that as I tell my story. So I just wanted to share a little bit from, if you look it up on the web, you'll find something about the 1940s preamble to AA. And it just has a different flavor and tone. I'm just going to read two small paragraphs from that, which says, "We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree as you see fit. In fact, it is suggested that you pay no attention to anything which might not be reconciled with what is in the AA Big Book. It says, if you don't have a Big Book, it's time you bought one. Read it, study it, live with it, loan it, scatter it, and learn from it what it means to be an AA." So that's my inspiration today. And as I tell my story, you'll kind of see I was very misguided within the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous, going to meetings and hearing things which didn't actually square with the directions in the Big Book. And when I finally got recovered, it was because I looked and studied and read the Big Book with a recovered sponsor. That was the key to my recovery. I'm playing with the light here. I'm just not quite sure I'm getting the lighting correct. Anyhow, was I born a compulsive eater? I don't know, but as long as I can remember, I had a strained relationship with food. You know, when I talked with my mom about this, I said, you know, hey, I remember going to this place and we lived here, and I just remember these big donuts. And I just remember, just like, you'd take us there, and I just remember this. And she's like, oh, yeah, did you remember we went to the library, too, when we go out? No, I have no memory of that. Do you remember we'd, you know, do this? No, I have no memory of that. And from as long as I can remember, you know, food, especially certain types of food, had this tremendous significance. And it was just more consequential and bigger in my mind than it was. And I noticed I was different from a lot of my friends in this respect. And I can remember being, you know, as an adolescent, 10 or 12 years old, you know, we somehow got our hands on these cookies and my friend ate them. And when I found out he had eaten them and not saved any for me, I was just crying my eyes out. And I was so upset. And I just had this experience that food meant something to me and did something for me that just was more so than it seemed to do for other people. And even at that time, 10 and 12 years old, I had this feeling and this idea that I was so fat. I had gained some weight. I was eating too much. And what came hand in hand with me, and maybe this is for you too, hand in hand with gaining the weight, fame. Anybody relate? Shame is a huge part of this disease for me. And hand in hand with this, the weight, the food, the importance of food, attempts to control. My attempts to start controlling the food and to go on diets started as a 10, 11 year old, trying to control. And yet at the same time, I had this experience that I couldn't quite get control, and food seemed to take this pretty interesting and extreme focus and importance in my life. It was somehow more central, more important than, again, to other people. And I compare myself a lot because I learn by contrast. And I remember as a high school kid, you know, coming home and, you know, just making certain combinations of food, putting bread on a fry pan with butter and making this half gallon size thing of chocolate milk, and sitting in front of the TV, and just this sense of insatiability and just zoning out and anesthetizing with food. And for me, food did something for me and created a certain sense of craving and a certain sense of an effect that was very specific. And what I later learned is that that I was suffering from something called a spiritual malady. And the spiritual malady means we're restless, irritable, discontent people, self-centered people. And we have this strategy. For me, food was this strategy, this thing that I could use that could give me a relief and a release from that bondage of myself, that way that I felt on the inside. I could eat certain types of foods, and I could finally take a deep breath. And I could relax, and my brain could stop, and fear would drop away. I didn't realize all this was going on at that time, but I constantly was in this roundabout around food, constantly thinking, I eat too much. I'm going to gain weight. I'm fat. I need to lose weight. So in order to lose weight, what do? I restrict. Then restrict until I can't. And then I go back the other way. So I was on this pendulum of, here I'm restricting and I'm telling myself I'm fat, I need to gain control. And then I'm eating less than I need. And then I can't stand it anymore. And I binge and I swing the pendulum along to the other side. And I go about 100 miles past this middle point, which is enough, which is satiation, sanity. I zoom past that to excess and indulgence. And with the excess and the indulgence, for me, came this tremendous sense of shame. And I had extreme distorted thinking about my food, how much food I could eat, what types of food I should eat. And my mom was a dieter, and I started trying to figure out, you know, different, reading different books, studying, trying to figure out the right combinations. This started to become somewhat of an obsession. But it always landed me in this place of out of control, shame. I'm bad. There's something wrong with me. I can't control this. So in high school, the body image was hugely distorted. I remember taking a vacation to Mexico. It sticks out very distinctly in my mind. And I saw a picture of that time, and I just looked very thin. You could just see how, you know, thin I was, athletic. And I remember that time. I remember thinking, I'm just so fat. I'm overweight. And so I had this body dysmorphia. As a college student, I found myself going to see counselors and talking to people about my food and my compulsive eating. And I started to make myself throw up around this time. And I knew something was weird or wrong or off about my food and my eating. And underneath that, there was what the big book talks about as a spiritual malady. talks about yes, this spiritual malady, this depression, this disease, discomfort with life. You know, I just always had this feeling of like, it's never enough. I'm not ever good enough. I'm never quite where I need to be. I'm never quite with the people I want to be with. And I'm never quite the person I think I should be, which leads to just extreme discontentment. So around the age of, 20, 21, I'm starting to go to meetings of Overeaters Anonymous. I'm walking into, dimly lit church basements with circles of mostly middle-aged women, some of them quite obese, middle to older age women, and thinking, I don't want to be a part of this group of losers. And that was my judgment, right? I didn't want to be there. I didn't think I belonged. It didn't look like them. I wasn't that overweight. And I had a big part of my brain and my personality that questioned for a long time, am I really even a compulsive eater? And I'd go to these meetings and I'd hear things like share it or wear it. And I'd think, oh, that means I need to get my feelings out. And then, my therapist would say, yes, get your feelings out, because then if not, you're going to want to eat because of stress. And these are all conventional sort of approaches to compulsive eating or binge eating, which don't apply to me. They've never, ever, ever worked. Can anybody relate to this? Like some of these conventional strategies? Yes. Thank you, Lisa, Paula, Chris. Like, these conventional things about, just reduce your stress and you're not going to eat compulsively and, manage your portion sizes and, brush your teeth once you finish your meal. None of these things come close to answering the question and becoming a solution for what I suffer and struggle with. So through my 20s, I would go to Overeaters Anonymous, and I think going to Overeaters Anonymous and being part of Overeaters Anonymous was meant to go to meetings. That's what I thought this was. And I only learned later on that there's two parts of this program. Well, at least two main parts for me, which is a program. And the program is a path of recovery as outlined in the 12 steps 1 through 12. And then there's a fellowship, and the fellowship of the people are the people that get together. Now you can have fellowships that get together and they don't talk about steps 1 through 12. And they talk about other things, and they want to talk about setting boundaries and reparenting their inner child. And for me, that kept me in a place that was very sick and confused. And there was a version of kind of craziness that I sort of experienced, which was going to 12 steps groups and not working 12 steps. So I didn't have a good conception of that. I didn't, and that's not just on those groups. That's also, maybe I wasn't ready to hear it, but I spent a long time from age 20 to age 37, circling the drain. And my disease of compulsive eating, my disease of bulimia kept getting worse. My weight kept getting bigger and bigger and more, despite all my efforts, compulsively exercising in spades and going through periods of some restriction and some control. And every time I'd experience such deep dejection and despair and failure at trying to control and eat sanely, I would go back to Overeaters Anonymous meetings. I'd go back to those meetings and I'd dabble in step work because I'd hear things like, take what you want and leave the rest. So I started to work a program of piecemeal program of doing it kind of my way, doing what felt good, working with sponsors that would let me eat what I wanted to eat, that wouldn't go through the big book with me, and look at the fundamental program that for me really worked in the end. So I spent between the ages of 20 to 37, progressively struggling within the fellowship, periodically hearing about, big book recovery and different meetings. that study the Big Book, that have a strong, strong base of recovered members, and sort of avoiding that and never quite approaching that, but suffering and struggling, getting bigger. And through that time, I had all sorts of, you know, attempts to get the food under control, all sorts of self-management strategies and studying hypnosis and reading different books and practicing, you know, different methodologies. And it just left me back to eating the same foods that I vowed I wasn't going to eat, that were killing me, that were making me overweight. And, you know, that would lead me to, you know, vomiting, throwing these foods up. You know, so I started just getting more and more serious about recovery. And I'd hear things like, work every tool every day. Now, forget about the steps. I wasn't working the steps, but I'm going to work every tool every day, which means I'm going to call you and I'm going to talk to you about something. And I'm going to think you are going to be able to talk me out of eating that next compulsive bite. And guess what? It never, ever quite worked, because you couldn't be in my head and you couldn't provide me the defense that I needed. Because in my head, no matter how hard I tried, there always came the thought of, maybe I should just eat that thing, that thing that I really, really love, that certain binge food. And then I turn away from that. I say, no, no, no. And that back and forth for me can only go on for so long before it drives me absolutely insanely crazy. And I have to make it stop. So I started to go through some more serious efforts into Overeaters Anonymous. And I got with a sponsor who said, work every step every day. And, slowly started working through steps, but not as outlined in the Big Book, you know, writing a step a month. And he so strongly suggested to get rid of flour and sugar. And so after attempting to do recovery and count calories and not be successful, I finally said, okay, I'll do it your way. And I became, Mr. No Flour, No Sugar, strict food plan guy. And I thought I had the answer, and I saw nutritionists, and I had this revelation of what was enough. Like, I had a nutritionist tell me what I needed to eat to fuel my body and my lifestyle. And, you know, I'm super athletic and super active and 6 foot tall, and, you know, 200 pounds is a very good weight for me. And I thought I had the answer. And I embraced that. And I was calling people every day, but I was trying to outrun an avalanche. And that avalanche was my obsessive mind that said, you got to go back to those foods. You should break your abstinence. And then I'd say, no, 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 I'm not going to break my abstinence. So we have a factor of this disease it involves the mind. It's a mental obsession. Mental obsession for me would manifest in the fact of saying, I should eat this food. No, I'm not going to eat that food. I should break my abstinence today. No, I'm not going to break my abstinence today. And I was wound up like a spring doing this, trying to have abstinence without any recovery. I was wound up like a spring. I was intense. And I tried to work every single tool every day to the max. But I was trying to outrun that avalanche, because that obsession of the mind was just hunting me down. And I still had a spiritual malady. I still had something in me that was restless and irritable and discontent. And I still couldn't be comfortable in my own skin. And so the food kept calling me, and it kept calling me. So for me, trying to work a food plan and make a few phone calls was torture. I tortured myself with that. Until I would break my abstinence repeatedly. The furthest I ever got towards that was around 100 days. And I just remember the thought coming back, you should break your abstinence. No, I don't want to break my abstinence. You should break your abstinence. No, I don't. And just like, incessantly, just I could not escape it. And this darkness would come and it'd just say, you should break your abstinence. And I remember, you know, I couldn't escape it. And I couldn't make that phone call to talk to somebody, because they didn't have the power to stop that. And I remember I'd be going to sleep at like 5 o'clock at night, trying to get out of my own head and wake up the next day and hope it's gone and try to start my day over. And just like, just trying to escape that, trying to hold my breath. It's like holding my breath underwater. The urge just builds and builds and builds and builds. And I remember going to bed at 5 o'clock one night, trying to get away from that in my head, 90 some days abstinent, wound up tight, and went to bed early, woke up early, and that urge was still there. And shortly thereafter, I found myself in the middle of winter in a parking lot outside a fast food place eating ice cream and hating myself deeper than I probably ever hated myself. And this just brought me at age 35, 36, 37, before I got abstinent, to such deep, deep places of despair and hopelessness. And yet I think I still had this pride, this part of me that couldn't fully submit and surrender to a program. And so around age 37, I was doing this dance of like in program, in meetings, some abstinence, trying to work with sponsors, trying to get abstinent, working a food plan, really intense on this food plan, dabbling in step work, not really committing, unreachable. People couldn't quite reach me, and I didn't realize I wasn't really open and willing. I had an experience, which is a step one experience. And I happened to be in that place of not abstinent. I went to a gathering in Newark, New Jersey in 2017. And I heard from a group of people called the Vision for You. Some of you may know them. Some of you may be a part of that meeting. And I sat in conference rooms with people who were alive in a way that I hadn't seen before. They had a certain spiritual connection that I hadn't seen before. When people talk about a twinkle in a person's eye and seeing into somebody's soul, that's a possibility. That's a real thing. That's a real thing that you can see when you come into contact with an awakened person and a person in those circumstances that knew who I was and knew how I was. And I was very, very inspired by that conference. And I ended that conference on Sunday morning listening to an impassioned Step 12 speaker speak with just this great passion about how we can go out and change the world and be a light to those who are suffering and carry this message. And I felt goosebumps, and I felt the energy of that room, that you could hear a pin drop, and that people were there wrapped with attention, listening to such power and passion from a man who had lost hundreds of pounds and stayed abstinent and recovered for years and years and years. And I think it was in this experience over this weekend that I became 100% convinced that it is possible to recover, to be fully out of the food and to live on a different basis. And I saw that. And I was amazed, and I thought this could be the start of a new abstinence. I had a sponsor. I went home Sunday night and I ate compulsively and I threw up. And I said, this is absolute insanity. I know recovery is possible. I cannot keep living my life this way. And I was very suicidal at times. Like when I say I cannot live my life this way, I mean, I literally cannot keep living my life like this. The pain, the sadness, the despair is so great. The shame is so great. I cannot live my life this way. I have to stop. I cannot do this. And again, I knew recovery was possible. I'd seen it in people's eyes secondhand. And I woke up the next morning, I can't live this way. And I binged and I purged and I couldn't stop. And I said, this is absolutely insane. I cannot live this way. I have to stop. I did the same thing Tuesday and Wednesday morning. I wanted to stop. I couldn't stop. Thursday morning, something happened. I can't take credit for this. I can't say I surrendered. I think I was surrendered. Something happened inside of me. I broke. Something broke. The obsession to eat compulsively momentarily lifted. I found within me a willingness to eat an abstinent food plan. I had gotten a sponsor at that conference, and I called him and I said, I am willing to go to any lengths to recover. This is the first time I'd ever been willing to go to any lengths. And that very night, on a Thursday night, I was calling people from that conference, and I had a desperation and a willingness that I'd never had before. To give you an example of this, I was dating a married woman at the time. And I said, how come, that's this guy. I said, how come some people say, you know, you can't be doing unethical things and you know, being with married women while you're trying to recover? And he said, it's a spiritual program, and spirituality is inherently ethical. And you can't be doing unethical things and trying to have a connection with God. And almost before he could finish these sentences, I said, I'll be done with her. I'm done. Done. Just no second thought. It's over. It's over. I understood. I asked the same person, I said, how come we say God has to do this for us, yet we still have to be willing to go to any lengths? So I'm a smart guy, which is a problem at times, because I had this question for a long time. These two things seemed incongruous. They didn't seem to match. How could one be true and the other one be true? God is going to do this for us. Yes, we have to be willing to go to any lengths. Because I used to hear things in meetings, and again, they were.
That's 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Thank you. I used to hear things in meetings that weren't in the big book, but things like wake up in the morning and ask God to keep you abstinent, and go to bed and thank God for keeping you abstinent, and wake up and ask God to keep me abstinent, and I wouldn't be abstinent, and I'd end the day cursing God. I didn't work steps 1 through 12 or any version of those in between, and I was therefore faltering in my recovery, and I was not practicing a program of recovery. So I encourage you strongly to do what the what I read to you earlier. If anything I says doesn't square with the message from the big book, or you're confused, ask me follow-up questions, read the book. During this time, around September 22nd, 2017, when I asked this question, how is it that we have to go to any lengths and yet God is going to do for us what we can't do of ourselves, I became teachable at that moment in a way that I'd never been teachable. And I started to feel a certain willingness and a certain power and a certain desperation that I'd never, ever, ever felt. And I decided and was willing to study the big book and to work steps 1 through 12 as outlined in the big book. And as a result of that, I have had a spiritual awakening, and I have experienced something unique and powerful and profound. And if you haven't experienced it, come along for the ride, because it's pretty darn amazing. The key thing in my story was that step one experience. And I'm confused because I didn't do step one on Thursday, September 22nd, 2017. Something happened to me where I broke deep down inside and I gave up. Step one is a giving up step. It's an I can't step. It's a teach me step. It's an I'm done step. I want to get better. I'm willing. I'm dying. I need to live. And recovery is a being reborn. And, you know, I worked the program like I'd never worked it. You know, I listened to podcasts. I didn't listen to podcasts as I was driving down the road. I listened to podcasts as I was writing notes feverishly, because I don't learn unless I write stuff down. And I gave 100% of my attention to those podcasts. And I spent however long, 2 hours, whatever it took, I spent that time. And I became so determined to recover that, you know, one night it was getting a little late. I felt a little unsteady. I started making calls and I just couldn't get a hold of somebody. And I just started to feel this little bit of desperation inside of me. And I said, you know what? A Vision for You has a member list with 10 or 15,000 people on it. And I'm going to start with Susie Aardvark and go all the way to the Z's if I need to. And if I don't get a hold of somebody, I'm going to start over. And I burst into tears with that willingness. And I felt something come into my heart and my spirit that I was going to be okay, that God had me, because I was willing to humble myself to such a profound and deep level, to reach out to my fellows, to reach out to God, to follow instructions and to be teachable. And I went into the staff work with this deep, deep first step experience, which I think is a true, true blessing. And it's something that stayed with me at on a deep level. It's kind of just such a true thing in my life. Like, kind of like I have this, you know, beard and blue eyes or green eyes. I don't even know what color they are, but, you know, not brown eyes. It's true for me, like gravity is true. And I've been really, really blessed. I just don't know how to impart it to sponsees. That's the only thing. I don't quite know how to impart it. But studying out of the big book, I started to realize there's so many things I heard in meetings that weren't a part of this program of recovery. Because I hear things like, don't eat no matter what. And yet it is of my nature to eat no matter what. And I'd hear things like, keep it green. And then I'd read the big book and it'd say, we can't bring a memory of our previous pain or suffering into our mind with sufficient force to deter us from eating compulsively. And I used to have these lists of all the consequences of my eating compulsively that I thought would keep me abstinent and keep me on the straight and narrow. What I learned from the big book, working the steps out of the big book, is I was truly powerless. I had warped. One of the ways it said in the big book is we've warped our mind to such a degree with obsessive drinking that only an act of providence will save us. It might say that in the 12 and 12. I needed a spiritual awakening, no Weight Watchers or I'd hear people say, call me before you eat compulsively. I said, yes, that's great. And now I'll never eat compulsively again. I'll always call you. And I wouldn't make those calls. I'd hear things, you know, meeting makers make it. I'd go to a ton of meetings and I'd hate and learn to hate meetings. And I get really resentful. I'd hear people say, share it or wear it. And I couldn't share enough and I couldn't go to enough therapy. And I always ended up defeated, dejected. So studying the big book and studying some of the history, and that's why I, you know, if you look at the 1940s preamble, if you study some of Bill Wilson's further literature, if you study some of the history and some of the grapevine articles that Bill Wilson wrote, see where his thinking is, and you look at some of the history, and right on the inside cover of the big book, there's suggested historical readings. You start to understand the context with it within which the big book was written. It helped you to sort of interpret. Wait,
sorry to interrupt, that's your time.
Okay, so yeah, thank you. Thank you everybody for your time. I'll end there. An incomplete story.
Thank you. Thank